From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Randy Poe. Not the Randy Poe who is a mathematician or the Randy Poe who sells real estate in Florida. This Randy Poe is the president of Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing and was the executive director of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Of course, Lieber and Stoller are the composers of some of rock and roll's greatest hits, so Randy Poe has encountered many of the greatest performers of those songs over the years. Randy Poe has also written several books, including Sky Dog, the Duane Allman story. The story of Randy Poe's life as a song pugger is the subject of his new book, Stalking the Redheaded Stranger. Randy Poe, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, Randy Poe, I know that your book, Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, has a subtitle, but our show is only a half hour.
I understand, and I don't even know what the subtitle is.
It's a long one. We'll get to it later. So before we talk about your song plugging, I just have to make you tell our listeners, just to start things off, about the night Bob Dylan was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That's my favorite story.
Okay.
Can you do it? Will you do it?
I'll do my best. Okay. I'd always been a huge fan of Bob's, and he had actually recorded a couple of albums in Muscle Shoals, which was where I grew up. And but we'd never met. I just was very excited about this opportunity, and the day before Bob was being inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, Bob's office called me and said, you know, Bob just can't come walking in the front door of the hotel. You're going to have to find some way to sneak him into the hotel so that he's not accosted by journalists and fans and things. And I said, well, okay. So I went over, this is the New York Hilton? Waldorf Astoria, they all melt together after a while. It's a hotel in New York, and I met with the staff there and said, look, Bob Dylan's coming here tomorrow night, and you're going to have to show me how I can squeeze him into this place without the press seeing him. And they said, okay, so his limo can come, they can park around back, and you go down these stairs into this underground basement, which is just all these twists and turns, and it just went on and on. It was like a maze. And then they said, all right, and then you'll come to this elevator here, and the two of you will get on this elevator, and you'll go up, and that elevator will open, and you'll be in the kitchen, and then you come through the kitchen, and then you'll come through this door here, and that way he'll be in the reception area, and you won't have to worry about the press being at the front of the hotel and the fans being at the front of the hotel. Everybody's going to be expecting him to come in through that door. He's going to have come in through the back way and through the circuitous route, and everything will be fine. I said, okay, great. So I have, and I talk about it several times in the book, I have a horrific sense of direction, which makes the idea of me chasing Willie Nelson across Canada even funnier. But so I was panicked all night long. I was like, how am I going to remember this incredible route that I have to take through this maze in the basement of this hotel? This is literally a nightmare. And I get to the event the next evening, and all these people are coming in, and this was the year that Paul Simon was being inducted, and Kander and Ebb were being inducted, and all these wonderful people were coming to the event, including Woody Guthrie's widow and daughter. Of course, Woody had been a huge influence on Bob Dylan, and as Marjorie Guthrie is coming off the elevator, I'm going towards her to shake her hand, and the gentleman who is the PR director for the Songwriters Hall of Fame just grabs me by the arm and says, he's here. Bob's here. I'm like, okay, I got to go down the elevator in the kitchen and head through the maze. And I said, all right, I'll be right back with him. And he said, no, he's here. He's in the reception room already where the cocktail hour is going on. I'm like, you're kidding. So I go through the swinging doors, and he's standing in this, it's a big reception area, like you can imagine in a hotel, and right on the other side of this big reception area, you go through swinging doors, and there's the ballroom where the rest of the evening will take place. And I walk into this room, And to my far left is a bar with men in tuxedos and women in fancy formal dress. To the far right are more men in tuxedos and women in fancy dress. And standing by himself in the center of this room in a brown suit with no tie is Bob Dylan. And I mean, I was stunned, and I looked, and I could see that the press was way down at the far right end of the room, and they were talking with other people, and luckily none of them had spotted him yet. So I just made a beeline for Bob, introduced myself, introduced my fiancé to him, and told him how glad we were that he had come, and said, "Is there anything we can get for you? Anything in the world you need, just let me know." And then he said in that perfect nasally Bob Dylan voice, "Yeah, I'd like to get a picture taken with Dinah Shore." And I thought, well, that's an interesting sense of humor. Dinah Shore was receiving that night a Lifetime Achievement Award from the organization. And so I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I determined he's serious. So I told my fiancé, I said, "Go get Sammy Kahn, who's the president of the Songwriters Hall of Fame at that time, and let him know that Bob would like his picture taken with Dinah Shore." So moments later, she comes back with Sammy. I introduce Sammy to Bob, and Sammy sends one of his minions off to find Dinah. And so Bob Dylan, Sammy Kahn, Sammy's wife, me and my girlfriend, fiance, go to the kitchen of the hotel, and we're hiding behind a partition waiting for Dinah Shore to show up. And while we're waiting, I sent another person off to find a photographer that we use named Sam Teicher. And I said, "Go get Sam. Tell Sam to come to the kitchen. Don't say nothing to nobody. Just come to the kitchen, and he'll see why we need him." And so down, I watched them come walking one by one. First Sam, the photographer, and then Dinah Shore, who's being drugged by a couple of gals that are helping us with the production of the event, because she doesn't have a clue what's going on. And they're like, "You just got to come in the kitchen, Miss Shore." And so she comes around the corner, and to see the look on her face when she sees that Bob Dylan is standing there, it was priceless. And so they hugged, they kissed, they got a bunch of pictures taken together, and I thought, sheer genius on Bob's part. I thought, this is a man who knows and understands public relations and marketing better than anybody on the planet, because when I woke up the next morning, every newspaper had that story with that photo with Bob Dylan and Dinah Shore standing there together, and they all had the same caption, which was, "The times they are a-changing." And by the following week, it was in Rolling Stone, it was in People, it was in the gossip rags, as you can imagine. And so it was this wonderful story. And one of the people who had been there with Bob at Bob's table the night of the Songwriters Hall of Fame event was David Amram, one of the greatest of America's 20th century composers, but a man who is not a snob by any means. David will play with anybody who will let him, because he plays penny whistles, he plays tambourines, he plays everything under the sun. Of course, he plays piano, but... So we flash forward a few months after the Songwriters Hall of Fame dinner, and I see David Amram at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and David sees me, and he calls me over to the fence, which he's standing behind, on the good side. He's backstage. I'm not. And so I feel like I'm in prison looking at him through the chicken wire, and he says, "Hey, you're the Songwriters Hall of Fame guy." And I said, yeah, I'm Randy Poe. And he said, "So how about that night when Bob got his picture taken with Dinah Shore?" I said, "Yeah, that was kind of crazy, wasn't it?" And he says, "You know why he did it?" And I said, "Well, David, it's a wild guess on my part, but I presumed it was because he knew the next morning everyone in America would wake up to all this press about Bob Dylan and Dinah Shore being together, and he said that it's a good guess. That's not the reason he did it. He said when Bob finally got through having his picture taken with Dinah and came over and sat down at the table with the rest of us, of course I had to ask him, Bob, what are you doing? Why are you having your picture taken with Dinah Shore? And he said, Bob said to me, because now my mother will finally think I'm somebody.
That's right. He was the voice of a generation, but until he got his picture taken with Dinah Shore, he's
right.
Nobody. Did you see my boy with Dinah in the back?
Yeah. Finally. He's hanging out with somebody that can sing.
That's music. We're talking with Randy Poe, and his book is called Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, or How to Get Your Songs into the Hands of Artists Who Really Matter Through Show Business Trickery, Underhanded Skullduggery, Shrewdness and Chicanery, as well as various less nefarious methods of song plugging, A Practical Handbook, and Historical Portrait. Frank Sinatra figures in your story, and I was thinking about Sinatra a minute ago when you were talking about Sammy Kahn and Paul Simon. I was watching, I think it was the Dick Cavett Show one night, and he had a songwriter's forum, and he had both Paul Simon and Sammy Kahn, and they were talking, all the songwriters were talking about what a thrill it is to have Sinatra record your song, and Paul Simon said, yeah, well, he recorded Mrs. Robinson, but it had some stupid lyrics that I don't have any idea where those lyrics came from, and Sammy Kahn says, oh, I wrote those.
Sammy was a master at that. He and I, we got to spend a lot of years together, and it was just truly an honor for me. I always said it was like having my own personal Groucho Marx, because he was one, when he wanted to be, when his mood was the right mood, he was hilarious. And to get to just sit there and listen to the punchlines all day long, it was a wonderful experience. But he confided in me about a lot of things, and one of the things that he did was corporate concerts. And he would just have AT&T, whoever it was, give me a name of all your top people. And the more difficult last name to rhyme, the better. And he loved taking situations and the names of the top employees of big corporations, and they would pay him an absolute fortune to do like 20 minutes. And he'd just hire a piano player, go in, be funny as hell for 20 minutes, take his massive check, and go home. But he had an incredible gift that was, and I don't mean this in any negative way, but very savant-like. You could pick any five single syllable words. It didn't matter. If it could be rhymed, he would rhyme it. and it didn't matter how big the word was. In his mind, instantly, he knew a word that rhymed with that, or could make an inner rhyme that was unreal. And he did a rhyming dictionary, and I'm sure that it was almost effortless for him to do that. But yeah, he was the king of the Sinatra songwriters. Well over 100 of Sammy's lyrics were sung by Frank, including some that, of course, were attributed to other people.
Yeah, yeah. And so your bosses, Lieber and Stoller, they're famous for writing Hound Dog.
They wrote on Broadway. Yeah. They wrote a lot of Drifters hits, including There Goes My Baby and Dance With Me. And the confusion comes because they produced a whole slew of Drifter songs that they didn't write.
Yeah.
Yeah, they wrote all the Coasters hits, Charlie Brown, Yakety Yak, Little Egypt, and Elvis just goes on and on, Jailhouse Rock, Trouble, Loving You, Love Me, Treat Me Nice, Just Go So Square, Baby, I Don't Care. So, yes, they had this rather vast catalog of songs they wrote, including Kansas City, and anybody who saw the All-Star game.
They played it last night. Yeah,
wasn't that wonderful?
Yeah. I thought of you because I just read your book. And now, I heard a story, you probably know if it's true or not, that they actually conceived of a Broadway musical for Elvis, but the Colonel didn't want to do it.
What they had come up with was Elie Kazan had written a novel, and they went to the colonel and said, look, Elvis is a good actor. He needs to have the opportunity to do a serious work, and this is the perfect combination for us to put these people together with Elvis as the star of this movie. And the colonel made it very clear that they were not to ever do such a thing again, because you know, he had a pretty much controlled Elvis. One of my closest friends was one of Elvis's closest friends, and it's just a mystery that the colonel had the kind of control that he had over Elvis, where Elvis was seemingly in every other way, he was a strong-willed person who was going to do things his way until the colonel said otherwise, and he always, kowtowed to Colonel Parker. They were one of the stories that Mike Stoller tells. That's in Mike and Jerry's joint autobiography. It's called Hound Dog. He talks about how he's with Elvis and the gang, and they're playing pool. And the colonel comes in and was not happy to see Mike there. And he made Elvis tell Mike, you know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to leave the room. Yeah. And it's like, really? You wouldn't even defend your friend? So he had a lot of powerful control over Elvis for whatever reason.
It's a mystery.
Yeah, but they had an idea for a movie. Now that you brought it up, I think it would have been brilliant to have Elvis do a Broadway show. But no, that wasn't something that was part of their world at that time.
No, of course. Later, there's a famous Broadway musical of all Lieber and Stoller songs.
Absolutely.
And now you got involved with them, and this book that you've written, we should mention the title again. It's called Stalking the Redheaded Stranger. And I love this book, and I think everybody will love it when they read it, because it's full of wonderful stories like that Dylan story I made you tell. But I like the way you structured it, where you hang it on this this task that was given to you by by your bosses.
Right.
They told you to take this Sinatra song and play it for your buddy Willie Nelson.
That's right. Yeah, it's specifically Jerry Lieber. Jerry was the lyricist. Mike's the guy who writes the music. And Jerry was the more gregarious. He was a wild man. I used to, just like I said, Sammy was like having my own personal Groucho Marx. I used to say Jerry was like having my own personal Keith Moon. Because he was quite the character. And I think he was one of the last of the great music business characters of his era. But so Jerry, I was at Jerry's house, and Jerry said, hey, you know, the Sinatra song, because they had only had one. Sinatra had recorded one song out of all the songs that Mike and Jerry had written and had so many hits by so many artists. Sinatra had only recorded one song, and it's a song that nobody knows, called The Girls I Never Kissed. And so Jerry said, I want you to take the Sinatra song, and I want you to play it for your buddy Willie. And I was at his house, sitting at his dining room table, racking my brain, trying to think of anyone I knew named Willie, and why I would want to take this particular song to Willie in the first place. And he says, and so I just kind of sat there and waited, and he said, you know, yeah, I know he mainly does country stuff, but he did that album of standards. And as soon as he said that, I realized he means Willie Nelson.
Your best friend.
My pal, my buddy, Willie Nelson. And I'm not sure, I think I said this in the book, but right then, any sane person at that moment goes, "Hey, boss, I don't know Willie Nelson. What are you talking about?" But I was looking at this from the perspective of, he's on a roll. Do I tell him he's wrong? So I just let him keep rolling. And he was explaining to me, you know, hey, he did the September song, which was a song about an older man. So it's not like he'd be averse to doing a song about as this older man. And it's, and like I say, he does standards, and I bet he's a big Sinatra fan. And so what you need to do is you need to burn a couple of copies of the CD, and I want you to hand deliver it to him and sit there with him face to face and play the song for him. Like, that's going to help sell the song at all, the fact that I'm there making him listen to it.
Because you're his buddy.
Because I'm his buddy, and so of course he's going to do it. So I'm like, okay, gotcha. And I got in my car, drove back to the office, and promptly completely forgot all about it. And because, in fairness to me at that point, Jerry Lieber had 100 ideas a day. And the reason you listened to them all was because one of them was brilliant. The other 99, you go, well, I don't know, boss. But one of them was always brilliant. And I'm not sure that this one qualified, but, hey, I got a book out of it. I'm sitting at the office. A couple of 3 weeks has gone by, and the receptionist tells me that Mike Stoller, my other boss, the other half, is on the phone, and I'm like, "Hey, man, what's up?" And he says, "Look, Jerry's really pissed at you." I'm like, "Oh, what did I do?" And he says, it's what you didn't do. He told you to take the Sinatra song to Willie Nelson, and you didn't do it." And I'm thinking in my mind, he was serious? So I'm like, okay, now, you know, Willie's on the road all the time. This could cost us a couple of bucks. And he's like, hey, do what you got to do, but I'm just telling you, Jerry's mad. You might want to try to get the song to Willie. And I said, oh, okay. And I used everybody I knew. I talk about it in the book. I went to Polestar. I discovered that he was in Canada. And he was in Canada going east, heading towards Newfoundland. And meanwhile, I'm sitting here right now in my office where I can see the Pacific Ocean. So this is the wrong direction, and he's headed the wrong direction fast. And so I called his manager. His manager wouldn't take my call. We're pals, but he never takes my call. I send a note to his PR person. She comes back and says, hey, you know, I'd love to help you, but I can't set up a meeting with Willie unless the manager is okay with it, and I can't get him on the phone. I'm like, oh, her either. So I thought, what am I going to do? How do I get to this guy? And I just start flipping through, you know, the world's last physical Rolodex, and I'm flipping through my Rolodex cards, and I see John McEwen. And the thing that I knew about John that tied into Willie Nelson was that John and I had had lunch one day at La Dome, which has already been gone for like 10 years, so this is how long ago it had been. And while we were having lunch that day at La Dome, he had said something to me that gave me the impression that he and Willie Nelson actually were pals and buddies. I couldn't even remember what it was. I just knew it had something to do with Vegas and John and Willie Nelson, and so I thought, oh, I'll give it a shot. Well, long story longer. I called him. I get his answering machine. I'm like, crap, where is he? I go to Polestar. And the thing about John is he has his own solo career, as well as being a member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which he has been a member of for, at this point, you know, around 45 years or so. And so I look up John McEwen on Polestar, and he doesn't have another gig till September, and this is May. And I'm like, well, where is he? Well, okay, I'll look up Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So I look up Nitty Gritty Dirt Band on this website, which, if I didn't say already, is a website that tells you where every act in the world is playing and will be playing for the next few weeks. And I go to look up the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and they are playing in Canada, too. And I thought, well, that's funny.
And they're heading for Newfoundland.
And these venues, they sound familiar. So I type Willie Nelson in and look at it, and they're the same venues. And I go back to the Dirt Band. It's not just the same venues, it's the same dates. And I realize the one guy I know on the planet who actually does know Willie Nelson is on tour with him. And so I emailed John, and John said, hey, come on up.
So you finally do get to Willie Nelson, and of course you made a terrible, terrible mistake when you were in Willie Nelson's presence, which was when Willie Nelson offered you a puff, you took one.
I think I took four. This is something I would not recommend, no matter how curious one might be. But you know, this was one of those when in Rome moments.
Yeah.
And you know, I explain in the book, backing up just a hair, the reason that Jerry Lieber thought Willie was my buddy. Because back when I had been with the Songwriters Hall of Fame, I had hopped into a picture with Willie Nelson. Willie had received an award the year after a year or two after Bob Dylan had. And so I had gotten to spend a little bit of time backstage with Willie. And then when Willie was going on stage, getting ready to perform his little set, which was going to be some of the songs from the Stardust album, because everybody in the room was like between 70 and 90, he had called me aside and said, is it okay if we open with Whiskey River? Because that's the song we use to tune up all our instruments. And so I looked at him and said, how could I say no to Willie Nelson? And so once I'm on the bus with him all these years later, and he hands me this joint that's, you know, the size of a Churchill cigar. I might be exaggerating. He says, you want a hit? And I, of course, said, well, how could I say no to Willie Nelson? And just for future reference, my advice would be, say no. Yeah, in that one instance, Nancy Reagan was right. After I had played the song for him and finally stumbled off of the bus and gotten back to my hotel room, I had an email from my friend Joe Von Herman, who lives right up in your neck of the woods. And Joe's email said, whatever you do, don't smoke Willie's pot. And it took me about a half hour to write back two words, which were, too late.
Well, listen, this book, it's called Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, and it's written by Randy Poe, and it's a brilliant book, and it's a lot of fun, and it really is loaded with not only funny anecdotes, but, you know, really actual facts, if you happen to be a song plugger, things you could use, and we appreciate that. Randy Poe, we just got started talking about your great book, and maybe you'll come back and have another conversation with us soon.
Absolutely. I'm happy to. I will hold you to it. The next one is so different, it's unreal. It's the authorized, technically the authorized autobiography of Buck Owens.
Oh, well, we'll be looking forward to that. Fantastic.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to finishing it.
Well, Randy Poe, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank Randy Poe. His book is called Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, or How to Get Your Songs into the Hands of Artists Who Really Matter Through Show Business Trickery, Underhanded Skullduggery, Shrewdness and Chicanery, as well as various less nefarious methods of song plugging, a practical handbook, and historical portrait. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf was provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.